Jema. So today we take up the subject of mental education from Collected Works of the Mother, Volume 12. So first a few questions that people often raise that normally in spiritual literature we'll see that mind and the vital are clubbed together. More so in modern spiritual literature, not in the ancient terminology. You have anamay kosh, pranamay kosh, manomay kosh. Very clearly they differentiated between these, they differentiated between prana and the mind. This is very clear differentiation. And the reason is that they spring from different layers of consciousness. So the logic of it was that just as the body springs or is formed by the action of the mind on the material consciousness, similarly it is animated by the breath of life from the vital consciousness, and the same body begins to think, become half conscious by the mental consciousness. So prana is the feeder, energy feeder system. Even in the cells, everywhere you will see this distinction. But generally in many spiritual literature you will see them all clubbed together, and that's partly because of this lack of a comprehensive understanding of the human system. Second reason, as I see, and I feel it's important to understand that they club this whole thing together as a circle of ignorance from which you have to come out. So generally mind is restless, and you know, emotions, thoughts, everything is taken together, and one has to cross beyond it. So this has done a lot of damage to our not only Indian psyche, but to the development of the Indian nation. For example, if you don't develop the mind, it's true that by some kind of a concentration, by an act of faith and aspiration, you will realize the divine, because realization of the divine doesn't depend upon the degree your mind has grown, but you won't be able to manifest anything of it. So even though in principle Brahman is that knowing which all else can be known, but that which is known, to express it you need nature and her instruments. So if the instruments are not ready, not prepared, you won't be able to express it. And that can be seen very well in many of the psychology, psychological understanding or even metaphysical understanding that you find in general average spiritual books. In fact, it's so less, so little, and so dissatisfying, because the mind was never developed as an instrument. I mean, whatever was developed in a yogi by his previous lives or grace, we may say, to that extent it's there. Like Vivekananda had a developed mind to start with. But a methodical development of the mind to become an instrument, mediating instrument between the divine reality and this world, that has not been done. And that's why education has that importance. If you have to go beyond the mind to the spirit, we don't need so much. We just need to know how to concentrate and how to discern. These are the two things that are required. Concentration, because that's the basic process by which one arrives at the divine experience and the divine realization. And second is, one needs to basically make sure that the mind doesn't get distracted into many things. So these are few things required. But thought mastery, to make the mind an instrument, all that is doesn't exist, because it's not considered necessary. So this is the second part we need to understand, why really we need to talk about mental education. And the third thing which is important is that, well, if you know, if the mind has to really become instrument, it has to have developed certain qualities. But before that we must understand what exactly is the mind. Like life, vital we understand, vital is the energy feeding system. So what are the things that impel us? So we see that, well, we are impelled by desire. So desire becomes a feeder, energy system. But we'll say, but desire is also in the mind. No, desire, we become conscious of the desire through the mental process. That means it takes a thought. But in animals, even without the thought, it has its own, you know, movement. Similarly, greed, lust, they are all vital, because they are pushing. Ambition is vital. But in human beings, with development of mind, they start giving names, they start using terminologies, which is in a way important. So the differentiation begins. But essentially, vital is all about energy feeder system. Similarly, love or emotions. So emotions again drive human beings. They push. They give a dynamic thrust. But we become aware of the emotions in the mind, through the mind. So we can see that if we combine mind, vital and the body, so body is a base, like a, it provides a stable ground for consciousness to develop. And then the life energy or the vital becomes the energy feeding system. We can say the force that moves matter. Without, if the body, if the vital is not operating, then even the mind gets shut down. So vital is the energy for the body, vital provide the energy for the mind, vital provide the energy even for spiritual pursuit. So if you are very tired, fatigued, we can't even, aspire. I mean, unless one has learned to dissociate. And the mind makes us aware in whatever half-measured way about what things are, how they operate, and then it defines, categorizes. So that is the function of the mind. By doing so, we become little bit conscious of what is happening within us. So development of the mind, it lays the foundation for the journey beyond. Otherwise, there are yogas where you don't need to involve the mind and yet you can journey, like purely breath techniques and hatha yoga. That's simply because as far as escaping from the circle is concerned, it's very easy. But if you have to work upon nature, if you have to transform nature, one needs to become conscious of the movements and activities. And the one instrument that we have till the soul awakens is the mind. When the psychic being awakens, then psychic being takes the lead. It has a light with which we can see things much more clearly. So this is about the mind, vital and the physical. Beyond the mind, of course, is layers of consciousness, the spirit and then the supermind. So this is the basic terminology. So what are the capacities one must develop in the mind? So in vital we have said refined energy. So energy should be more and more refined. Love should be more and more refined. Passion should be more and more refined, uplifted, everything to the extent it can be. There is also an interface between the vital and the mind, and that is speech. So speech is the expressive mind and the expressive vital, as if the two rivers are meeting together. So what really is the function of the mind and what are the capacities we need to develop? The basic capacity is attention and concentration. So difficult. I mean, so difficult means in general when we observe, just see when people are holding a conversation. See how much the mind will just, thought will jump from somewhere to other. Suddenly they will ask, oh, what were you saying? I didn't hear, because there is inattention. So first is attention, then there is concentration. Of course, it can be developed to the point of developing 8-fold concentration, 10-fold concentration, ashtavadhani, dashavadhani, but that's not really required because we are not interested in that kind of multitasking. But it's a capacity. So concentration, now just because we have mentioned the term, it means that if you are holding a conversation with 10 people, you take questions from everyone, then you start answering from there. And one by one, you have kept it in your active memory and then you are responding. So the question may be very different and yet you are able to respond by the capacity of multiple concentration. So concentration, multiple concentration is a capacity. With yoga it develops very soon, meaning thereby we need not just concentrate only the heart. We can concentrate in the heart, in the head, and above the head at the same time. We can concentrate on multiple centers at the same time. But that is for specialized practices of yoga. But learning to concentrate. So how do you teach children to concentrate? Teach them to concentrate on whatever task they are doing. They have, of course, special exercise like Mikado and all that. Carom board, a very good way to concentrate. Games, very good way to concentrate. Or if you are, let's say, things like even cutting vegetable or you are cleaning, so to concentrate. And it can be developed to exceptional level. In fact, many accidents can be averted if we have developed the capacity of concentration. Recently we had one in dining room, some people may be aware. So how did the accident take place? Very strange and sad. So there is a lady who has been working for a long time in dining room, and there is a coconut chopping machine. So she just was chopping the coconut, suddenly she realized it's hot, fan is not working or what. She looked up, what's happened to the fan. That inattention was enough to chop two fingers. That split moment. It's obviously very painful. Mother's grace, not only she survived, but the finger survived. Nowadays, there is a possibility of reconstructive surgery. But otherwise, we can imagine one moment. So normally people will say it was karma and all that. No, it is inattention. Mother says all accidents are because of inattention. And I have seen this so many times. If we are attentive at what we are doing. So ability to concentrate, ability to observe is one of the things. Concentration means the power to narrow down, absorb oneself completely in what one is doing. At least our phone teaches us that. But phone can also teach scattering if you are going from one WhatsApp to another. But to learn to read in a concentrated manner, that's why reading is so important. Because forget about concentrating inside on the divine presence if you can't even have a sustained concentration while reading a book. So that's why reading Sri Aurobindo's books is so important. It will help us. Minimum is when we concentrate, we have developed the capacity to focus, to bring all the threads of consciousness onto this center. So much of studies, you need concentration. For memory, you need concentration. For observation, you need concentration. To hold a meaningful conversation, you need concentration. So concentration, of course, for yoga, you need concentration. So it's the ability to narrow the consciousness. But equally, the mind must have the capacity for expanding the consciousness. And there again, it's very fascinating. Expanding, widening. Now, expanding and widening means that the mind should be able to accommodate very diverse viewpoints. For instance, can we reconcile communism and capitalism? We can reconcile. Can we reconcile even that the sun rises in the east or sun rises in the west? We can go to that kind of absurd things. Can we reconcile that the earth is flat and the earth is round or elliptical? We can go to most impossible things. Can we reconcile material life and spiritual life? So recently, I think in Gurugram, somebody asked that why should we pay attention to the mind and body ultimately if you have to realize the spirit? So that's exactly what reconciliation is. That if the mind and body physical is not developed, then one may realize, but one will not be able to express anything. It's very simple to reconcile the two. Because this is a common thing. People ask, how can you reconcile material and spiritual life? Very simple. Spiritual life is primary. Material life is meant to manifest the spiritual life. So one can find the reconciliation so many ways. Even how matter has come into existence, one can reconcile. That's how Sri Aurobindo says, the spirit by condensation, involution and concentration becomes matter. So matter becomes condensed spirit, but not densely packed in that sense. It becomes involved as it were. It's like white light by dimmer gradually fading into almost no light. So it becomes so easy to understand these complex things of creation simply by like transcendent, universal and individual Godhead. It's so easy to understand if the mind can accommodate these different ideas that, well, transcendent Godhead is like the author and universal is the poem he writes. Now, as many poems he may write, Mahabharatas of Mahabharata, yet the author is always greater than the Mahabharata of Mahabharata. Simple. That's transcendent. None of this can define him. Yet everything in the book is something of him flowing into the characters. It's so easy to understand transcendent and cosmic. What about the individual? Frankly, without the divine also expressing through the individual, the immanent divine, the individual being will have no reality, no possibility of relation, not only with God, but with people around. How do I connect? Through the ego? If that's the only operating system I have. Through certain laws which my ego will, but for what purpose? Because if ego is the only truth, then after my death or after the ego personality's death, there is nothing which is carried over. Why should I even bother or care? Because there is no me in the real sense. So these are simple things, but it's so strange. Like Buddhist thought, there are people who follow it and a pure Advaita, but they don't have an answer to this. I've discussed with people. I said, okay, according to you, that's what it is. Then in that case, why are you asking me to be whatever I should be? There is no I. It's like a pyaaj ka chhilka, onion peel. There is no I. Whom are you addressing that you should be free? There is no I, so there is no free, no bound. Ashtavakra Gita. There is none free, none bound, none seeking to be free. So the matter stops there. So all spiritual discussions has no meaning. God is what he is, he will do what he will do. So we have to, you know, that wideness which can accommodate very different viewpoints. And in practical life it's so necessary, in psychological relationship it's so necessary. Plasticity. So people often say, this were given to me by, the other day somebody asked. He said, but didn't God make the Mughals conquer India? I said, yes. And God toppled their thrones. So he didn't say that forever you will, God didn't sign a wakf deed with the Mughals. That is your making. He made the Mughals conquer. True, there is a reason for that. But equally, he toppled the throne when the time had come. So you can't say forever we must. It happens even in our everyday life setup, ashram setup, it can happen. Mother has given me this work. Yes. Did she say forever till your last breath you will do this work? You have to see the work is important. Supposing you have become incapacitated. Would you stick to this that no mother gave me this work? Or in the interest of the work and mother's service, you will say somebody who is more capable, more ready, can more manifest, if you have really got freed from the ego, you will do that. But see how the mind's bandwidth, plasticity, to change according to, adapt according to the divine will. So this plasticity. So this is the third thing. Then the capacity to organize life around a central idea. So people keep contradictory ideas in their head, and very often I also meet, they will say, yeah, 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 this. Then they will speak just the opposite. You don't know in their head, left side is Kaurav and right side is Pandav. They're constantly fighting because they don't know what is the central idea around which you have to place things. So everything has its right place. But for that we must discover the central theme. Otherwise it will be all chaotically placed. And of course the capacity for the mind to become quiet and silent. So these are some of the important aspects, and we can now read how Mother beautifully approaches it. So she speaks about mental education, and mental education has very little to do with schooling, though it is considered that schooling is all about mind. It's true. There is no vital involved. Nowadays people do have some art, painting, etc. But it's morely a tokenism, a lip service. Which means we are creating Frankensteins. Right at the school level, no art, no music, no poetry, extreme intellectual development of the left brain. You are creating asuras, basically. Whatever be your system of education, if you are not doing this, you are creating asuras. Basically, asura is that. Developed intellect and very unrefined vital, underdeveloped heart, emotions, love. He is an asura. So this is what this society creates. So that we discussed last time. But schools do give us opportunity to do mental gymnastics. And here we can also take up the impact of AI. So the problem of AI is bypassing the mind. Now the problem, some people say, no, it'll take us to the spirit. No, if your mind doesn't develop, where will be the instrument? You may have time. 99%, 0.9999% will not use that time to explore the spirit. They will misuse all that AI can give you. They will do now 3D chats. Or that's what people will do. I mean, so silly. Consciousness doesn't change because of, you know, technology. But a changed technology can use the same, changed consciousness can use the same technology in a better way. That's what the whole crux is. And most people will use the AI to write an essay and feel very happy. Maybe the teachers, unless they tell them what have you understood from it, that's the only way that the mind will be engaged. Otherwise the mind, you have written a very good essay and teachers don't have time. That means they should discuss. Okay, essay is very good. Don't ask them about what happened, that they will remember. So what have you understood? If I were to teach, let us say, children something like Mahabharata, I would ask them, what have you understood about the essence of the Mahabharata war? Let them come up with their own ideas. Play with those ideas. But if you tell them, write on the Mahabharata war, it's very easy. AI. Thankfully, AI cannot do the task of understanding. It can summarize. It can draw its conclusions based on the data. But understanding is something very different. Understanding has to go to the heart of things. It's like an insight. It doesn't have that capacity of a creative insight because it's dependent on data. So these are just some ideas which those engaged must understand. AI can be very damaging. I feel in most children it will lead to a damage of the mental faculties. Maybe in few it will save time from gathering data and give them time to understand. But this will be very few. And maybe some schools are going to use that. So she says these are the five aspects of mental education. We have already touched upon it. Development of the power of concentration, the capacity of attention. Many, many, many ways. You can go to the point of the slightest sound and then integrating all the senses operating simultaneously. Can you hear? Integrate them together because mind is the integrating sense. As I said, simplest is whatever work you are doing, do with attention. Development of the capacities of expansion, widening, complexity and richness. So, we read one kind of literature because we shun other, because we think it is going to disturb our mind and create cognitive dissonance. But actually, it's if you are really clear about your understanding. Of course, there is a stage when this can happen. But ultimately, if you are able to expand your mind to understand what's happening behind, then it also helps us to enrich the mental faculties. Richness, complexity. So all this cannot be in Mayavad, obviously. This has no meaning. Organization of one's idea around a central idea. A higher ideal or a supremely luminous idea that will serve as a guide in life. It could be anything, could be love, light, God, peace, harmony, unity. Pick up an idea and around, let everything in your life be determined by that central idea of a life. Then fourth is thought control, rejection of undesirable thoughts, to become able to think only what one wants and when one wants. This is it. Developed capacity to be able to observe thoughts and see them and to be able to reject what we don't want, to be able to accept what we want. And finally, development of mental silence, perfect calm and more total receptivity to inspirations coming from the higher regions of the being. So one thing, she makes it very clear, the mind is not an instrument of knowledge. Mind is an instrument which gives forms to knowledge which is received from above. So one can actually experience, say inspiration is coming, one can actually experience a tremendous pressure of like rivers of inspiration flowing, oceans of being, that's how it can be. And then the mind has to quickly pick up, give form and express through the speech. The vital has to collaborate. All this is happening in a split instance. It's not the mind that is knowing. But something else, the mind upturned toward the divine receives and expresses itself. And then she says, one of the commonest thing with children is constant dispersion of their thoughts, and the child has to become capable of a sustained effort of attention and a faculty of more and more complete absorption in the work at hand. And all methods that can develop this faculty of attention, from games to rewards, are good and can all be utilized according to the need and the circumstances. Personally, in my experience, I have seen When people go through psychological illness, say depression, and then of course more disintegrative states. So one of the things that makes me aware that the person is recovering is the capacity to concentrate. So I ask them, they are feeling better, they are generally feeling fine. I ask them, are you able to, let's say, read a book in a sustained way? They are not. Even if they read the word, the mind, the consciousness cannot concentrate. It's very interesting. It doesn't get dispersed. But equally, it's like a blank. The consciousness is unable to concentrate, even though they are reading a body of words. It makes no sense. And this we all must have observed, that it's one thing to read, quite another to concentrate. So reading can be a purely mechanical process, but concentration is from the consciousness. So games, rewards, anything. To love to learn is the most precious gift that one can give to a child. To love to learn always and everywhere, so that all circumstances, all happenings in life be constantly renewed opportunities for learning more and more and always more. And that's why the best method is not to just keep on teaching through the blackboard method, but to let children explore, and they come back and they discuss to each what happened, what did you experience. It could be simply how many stairs you have climbed. I used to do that in my classes. So ask them, how many steps are there? Not that I remembered, but I didn't need to remember. Because now I have gone past that and would concentrate on something else. But I would ask them randomly. So how many steps are there? Okay, flowers. What flowers you saw at the entrance? So that's something which you can notice. So, and there is always something new to discover. And then you go into the depths of it. So it's a sign of, again, your concentration which is there on things around. Everything can become an incidence. Like with children, I ask them that, what is the first thing that happens when you wake up from sleep? It's morning. Okay. So what is the message of the morning? What do you learn from morning? What do you learn from the sun? What do you learn from the moon? Start with natural objects. What do you learn from the stone? What do you learn from the mountains? That's why I had posted that poem after Madhuvan. On the mountains. And then Shubhendu says, just like when he describes the sea, he says, my soul is like that, steady and steadfast as the hills. To the sea he says, O sea, I come to measure myself with thee. So you see, sea as the idea of vastness, mountain as steadiness. So everything can become an occasion of learning, and you can go deeper and deeper and deeper. And to that we have to add the faculty of observation, precise recording and faithfulness of memory, which is so difficult. That's why when people describe an incident, mother says invariably, they attach some emotion and it distorts. That's why when people recount in quarrels at home, you said this on that particular day and moment. Now you are at loss. You don't remember a bit about who said what. You don't remember the context. It's not that there is something which is added always from you. If you notice carefully, we add from our emotions. So sometimes we say, oh, I ask them that, why did you draw this conclusion that this person wanted to hurt me, let us say. Said, no, he made his face like that. I said, like what? Can you make the face like that and show me? Now it's difficult. Now what has happened is, our emotions have been projected on the face, and you have given the face a twist. And then you have read intention. So it's so difficult to faithfully reproduce an event. That's why things like Sherlock Holmes and nowadays the serial Tenali Rama, I love it, because there's such a precision of observation and memory. A small thing he picks up, actually it's matched to Arthur Conan Doyle. He picks up, he smells it and sees it. Very good for children. You know, how to observe things. One is a casual observation, the other is small little details. And then you have a picture, a clearer picture, a better picture. So she says that for true memory, you should not just remember by rote, but by understanding. So understanding is when you explain, when you look deeper. And for that you have to raise two questions. Why and the how. Memory is what? What is written in the book? Whole paragraph. So people often, sometimes they ask me, you remember whole of Savitri? I say, that's not so important. Even a parrot can remember. That's true. But what have I gathered from Savitri and that, what has seeped into my soul from Savitri? Ultimately, that's my carry forward. Not that remembering, yes, one should remember, but I'm the understanding in this sense that what has it meant to you, to each one? Book like Savitri can never be really understood or explained. But at least each of us will carry some essence. To somebody, it may be the tale of the feminine. Shobhinda is placing the eternal feminine in front of the quest. To somebody else is the story of an incarnation of the Divine Mother. To someone else, Savitri is the light that leans into the dark abyss to rescue human beings. So many ways, 10 ways, you can just look at just this idea. And then when you look at just the first canto, so many ways you can look at it. But remembering is one part. It's the least important. But understanding. Even when you can't, like God, we cannot understand God. Understood. So should we not try to understand? No, we should try to understand meaning thereby. What is my conception or idea of God? That's why Shobindu says in synthesis, and Mother elaborates her first conversation in 1956, that if we want to practice an integral yoga, we must have an integral idea of God. So what is the integral idea of God? That he dwells in each element, for example. That he has become all these things. This is important. Otherwise we can never be able to form a clear conception. You will gradually show the child that everything can become an interesting subject for study if it is approached in the right way. So everything means the life of every day, of every moment, is the best school of all, varied, complex, full of unexpected experiences, problems to be solved, clear and striking examples and obvious consequences. My personal feeling is that's how all education should be. My personal take on this is, and I have seen this, that if you just let the child observe, move around, and then maybe the teacher should be there as a guide, gather them maybe after 1 hour, then ask them what each one observed and how they understand it. And if you can do that, or their day's experience, the first class should be, what was your day's experience from yesterday evening till today morning? Let them come up and just discuss. Others will become conscious. Not that everybody will discuss it, but they'll become conscious. Oh, there are ways I can understand this, look at it. Then, let's say in a biology class or something, leave them to explore and come back and then raise questions. Then that will stay. But you read from books and just rata, parrot it out, that's hardly anything. So this is how everything of life. It is so easy to arouse healthy curiosity in children because they don't know it. They are filled with wonder. Why is the sun changing color from morning to night? I'm sure many adults don't know the reason. Yeah, well, it's very interesting. And if you look into the Indian thought, there is a different name for each of the moment of the sun. And if you go into its symbol, it is very fascinating. For example, you'll see red color, always associated with the supramental, the highest truth, mixing with earth. Technically, you can say brown and orange. I don't know whether that color will combine, give rise to red or not. But red is that color where the highest light is leaning down and merging in matter. Now when you see the setting sun, it's red. How symbolic. And whole nature is reproducing a whole truth. The entire yoga can be understood just by looking at the movement of the sun. At least I have in my mind a whole list. So Savitri, the sun which is emerging, you know, it's not emerged. I'm just giving an example. So when does the sun rise? If you ask children this question. So what will they say? You see the timing, 5:29 a.m. or in winter little later. So they'll say like that. No. When do you sense that the sun is rising? There's a very nice term in Hindi, bhor. Bhor bhai pan ghat pe, mohe nat khat shyam jagahe. What is bhor? Bhor is sun has not risen outwardly to the eyes, but you feel that the morning has started. 4 o'clock, four-ish if you get up, you experience that sun which has not yet emerged from the womb of darkness but has begun to stir earth is Savitri, Savitra. So interesting, fascinating. And that which is hidden in the darkness is Martand. It's battling the night. You don't know. We don't know. We are sleeping. But it's emerging. So it becomes Martand, the warrior. Then the sun which is just emerged. Then you have Usha. So it's so amazing when we just look at the sun, the whole yoga, because that's the process in our life. There is the soul struggling to emerge, but covered with darkness, ignorance is Martand. Then when you feel some kind of, we are interested, attracted towards some philosophy or something, that is bhor. Savitri has started working. Then we say, ah, this is the path. See, the whole 12 names of the sun tell us all about the journey. And then it will go through different stages, labor, effort, midnight, becomes too much for us to bear. Because slowly the tap is increasing, that is tapasya. Very difficult. In the beginning, nobody is expected to do tapasya. Ah, mother will do everything. Everything is wonderful. All is good. Everybody is all full of that. No? Then when it is afternoon, mother, you are running away from that light into shade. Then she will say, make friends with the sun. Then slowly, 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 when evening comes, you say, okay, something has been done. See, the whole yoga. I am just giving one example. There are several others we can take. And then she says, another very good faculty which goes unnoticed is the power of imagination. She says, imagination develops the creative mental faculty and through it study becomes living and the mind develops in joy. And really, this is one thing which is so develops like anything by studying the what we call as myths. There are actual studies on it, and Carl Jung was very forthright. He said, if you read the myths, it really helps the mind to become creative. And personally, I have noticed that everybody I have seen, I have asked this question. No more now, but I used to see that people are very creative. So what is their engagement with the myth? They are interested in myths and they have read it. Because the myth is like, it is out of the box, out of the dimension. So it gives you a very different understanding of an event, which you normally, you know, anyways, I was saying that, you know, the Bhagavat. So that's how, it's so fascinating. When you look at that, Yamuna is in spate and Krishna is going. So a very stone-hearted and stone-minded person will say, oh, these are all stories, myths. What do you mean Yamuna is trying to touch the feet and all the chains are being broken? But if you have read it, you understand it's a complete story of inner life. A preparation followed by the birth, and then suddenly the chains become loose, and then the psychic has to grow, engage in the world play, fight the Mahabharata war. It's all so clear. To me, like entire yoga can be understood simply by reading the life of Shri Krishna. But it opens doors to creative imagination. And Shri Krishna has opened doors to such creative imaginations. You know, though people call him as a mythological figure, Rama they don't discuss. Because Rama they take it, oh, when it happened. And with Krishna people debate. 40% he existed, 60% he existed or didn't exist. But based on Krishna, you have art, you have painting, you have dance, you have music, you have philosophies. Love, such everything goes back to Krishna. War goes back to Krishna. Politics goes back to Krishna. Just one figure whom you regard as mythology has governed the mind and intelligence and creative faculty of a whole race, and you say it's a myth? Myth or real? I mean, the story of Krishna is unimportant that way. But the impact it had is so real, so concrete, so vivid, so lively. Much more than my father and grandfather, whom I have seen with my physical eyes, had. And on a whole generations, not on one generation. On generations after generations, spiritual paths, sects have come around Krishna. So this discussion I have, they say about impact. I said, yes, half the world may be Christian. But see the impact of Krishna. It's not in numbers. If you see the impact Krishna had, there is no unparalleled, unequaled. Not a single personality in the world, and I can say this again, throwing an open challenge, who had such an impact on the world as Krishna had. Not about numbers, but the number of activities that have come around from Krishna. Shiva also had, but Krishna is like amazing. So, imagination is so important. That's why Shubhendu says, if the gospels are a forgery, then thanks to the forgeries, because they have saved the soul alive. See, the moment you take Krishna's name, no, you become very fired, enthused. So, anyway, Sasi says that above all, that a single subject is approached in various, then suppleness and comprehensiveness. So she says, single subject is approached in various ways so that the child understands in a practical manner that there are many ways of facing the same intellectual problem, of considering it and solving it. And one can take any kind of problem, simply the problem of being regular. You can look at it from so many ways and solve it. This will remove all rigidity from his brain, and at the same time it will make his thinking richer and more supple and prepare it for a more complex and comprehensive synthesis. Then she speaks about how the ideas have to be organized and put in order. So that has to be around a central idea. So if the central idea is just having fun, so many things will have no place. Automatically go. If your aim of life is fun, then obviously meditation, concentration, yoga, development of the mind, reading, nothing will matter. But if the idea is the divine, all this can be. By the way, Krishna is also fun. Ultimately, even fun and frolic and laughter goes to Krishna. Flirtations go to Krishna. Just imagine, you know, what is left? House disputes, everything goes to Krishna. I mean, nothing he has left. Whatever he left has been left to Sri Aurobindo in his Krishna's re-avatar. So, which was of course the ultimate truth, the supramental transformation. He hints and then he stops. Okay. So, she says that the higher idea that will have the power to bring them harmoniously together. So, God exists. Now, this cannot bring everything together. So, you say God exists beyond. So, this cannot bring everything together. Then God exists within me. Even this cannot bring everything together. God in the cosmos. Even this cannot. Ultimately, God is everything, can put everything together. And then you have to, of course, the understanding or revelation of all this is different. But that there is nothing else but the divine. Now this can start bringing things in order. So people often ask, if that is true, sir, too wide, too bold a statement. So everything is divine. So you have to understand the divine in essence and the divine in manifestation. In the manifestation, divine is constantly breaking his own body and bringing a new body. Just as our body does that. The child develops into an adult. So when you see the civilizations, the same thing happens, that the divine brings certain things in manifestation, which later on he removes from the manifestation. And the sign is that people themselves want it to go. So yes, everything is divine. But in the manifestation, he is constantly changing. So we have to flow with the divine of the future rather than divine of the past. So that reconciles it. What was perfect in the past, becomes evil in the present, and has to be discarded in the future. Many things in India, many customs, culture, but India has been an evolutionary, Hinduism is a very evolutionary Sanatana Dharma way of life, so it has accommodated. But see what happened to Semitic religions. So that's why also madrasa teaching is so dangerous, because it is giving a very narrow, it's making a very narrow mind. Whatever is written in the Quran, you have to read it, you have to understand whatever was told that time, don't question. So it is going to create bigots, it's going to create fundamentalism, it's ultimately going to create it. So if you really are concerned about the good of the world, madrasas should not be supported. You can't stop people from doing what they want, but stop supporting it by whatever means. Otherwise you are directly or indirectly responsible. It's not about Hindu-Muslim. Even if a Hindu is teaching outdated concepts in a school, you have to tell him. Because this is dangerous and inimical to the world. So while we cannot do anything, possibly in a free society, you can't say, ki bhai, you have to stop. But stop supporting financially, economically, politically and other ways. Justifying it. Because it's creating narrow mind as opposed to wide and supple mind. So humanity is moving towards this larger synthetic world. So the choice of the central idea of your mental synthesis, she says, the higher and larger the central idea and the more universal it is, rising above time and space. Sanatana Dharma, rising above time and space. So people often say, how it is Sanatana? It's very simple. It has no birth date. And what has no date of birth has no date of expiry. I say it jokingly, but if you meditate upon it, you will see, discover, it's wonderful that you don't have a beginning. You can't date back that Sanatana Dharma started in, you know, 420 AD or some 5000 BC. No. They discovered the Dharma which is existing. Beauty is that even the Vedas say, technically, that we have got it from our forefathers. Who these forefathers are, nobody knows. So it is something which man has discovered, a self-existent reality, truth, and how it is operating in the world. So that's how it is Sanatana. So if the idea is universal, rising, that more numerous and more complex will be the ideas, notions and thoughts which it will be able to organize and harmonize. That's how Sanatana Dharma can accommodate diverse strands of ideas. So people often say, see, that's the problem. You have too many books, too many scriptures, too many gurus, too many. I said, yes, that makes a mind wider, complex, richer, supple. You have one book, one prophet, so your mind becomes narrow, narrow, narrow and bigoted. Very simple. Because you are not able to expand yourself. And she says it takes time to develop it. And then she speaks of the faculty of formation. This is so important. But learning is only one aspect of mental activity. The other, which is at least equally important, is the constructive faculty. The mind actually forms, and this is very simple to see. When you are watching a television show, your mind is constantly forming, creating formations inside, even after you switch off. I mean, mind has such a power that if you see a live snake, I don't know if somebody chance upon, or like in villages it used to be common, then for some time at night if you get up, the mind will, okay, somewhere this slithering creature may be around. Though he has been killed or gone. This is the power of the mind to form. We construct illnesses in the mind. We construct health in the mind. We can construct. And people don't understand. It's such a sad thing. Even here, suddenly, oh, Corona is back. Arey, yaar, Corona is, okay, it has been existing since time immemorial. They don't even go into reading that this is the same variant doing little bit face mask. It's not even the mutant coronavirus which has come. And the fact is, it is not till now like there is no, it's not harmful, something extra. So it's okay. Why you are bringing fear? Now people start constructing. So somebody asked me a question that what is the spiritual reason for coronavirus coming back again? So I said, stupidity of man. Human stupidity. Now let the person understand. I said, human stupidity. I mean, if you read a little bit, you will understand. But people again, you know, again masks must sell. Again this thing must sell. So this is the capacity of formation is so important in illness. Just to imagine that you're healed. This part is healed. Just this light is flowing into the system. This blockage in the heart is being removed. This knot is opening up. A hard knot, you know, when somebody is hurt, what happens? You become knotted up all inside. Just imagine mother's light coming and soothing it, opening up, opening this knot, opening that knot. Like Varuna, cutting the knots of Suna shape. And you become wide. And then you try to see, oh, but I was hurt. You don't find the hurt. It was a knot. You have opened it up. But we want to feel hurt. So you want to call back. Because it doesn't, ego takes a perverse pleasure even in the fact of being hurt. How can it be so simple? Oh, the other person didn't do anything to me. How can it be? So it's so strange. There is a kind of attraction towards hurt, suffering. But if we just practice this formation, but we see a person and have a formation, oh, he is my enemy. He was neither a friend as you believed nor an enemy. He is what he is. He's on his journey. Came together, nice, good. Parted together, fine. May come back again together. It's okay. It's part of the journey. But see how the mind constructs. And once it constructs, it has a whole package associated with it. That's why friendship works best. Because in friendship, you don't have these constructs. A friend may do everything for you. But you're not expecting that a friend will do everything for you. And there's a joy, there's sharing, there's companionship, there's travel, there is... Everything is there, beautiful, happy togetherness. Minus the expectations which come and of course a certain kind of interaction which is not really necessary. So that's why friendship is something which is so beautiful in the ashram context also, you see. The one thing which Shobhinder and the mother never objected to was friendship. Because friendship is something beautiful, it can grow, it's unconditional. So we have to, this faculty of formation is so important, she says. And then with that, there should be the will which translates it into action, the ideas. And then finally she says, it is good to set apart some time. So one is the mental purification, what thoughts we want, we do not want to observe. Because obviously thoughts which are going to hurt me. So people often say, oh, this person has hurt me. He is enjoying. I say, see, he has hurt you. Okay, fine. That's one step. He is enjoying is irrelevant now. What has that got to do now with you? He is enjoying or not enjoying? First of all, we don't know. Maybe he is cursing himself and outwardly you think he is enjoying. We don't know. Anyways, that's not important. Now the third layer is by thinking all this, are you helping your hurt state or you are making it worse? If you are making it worse, it's not good for you. You have to reject it. Because that's what happened has happened. Whether it should have happened, not have happened, why it happened, all this is past. Learn the essence, grow and move on. Because that is the ultimately the true thing. Otherwise, this will continue. It's like already, like, but we have this capacity. Oh, I am going to go through this surgery. So people are so tense for so many days. Then when the surgery is over, pata hi nahi chala. We didn't get to know. Then afterwards they will keep saying, oh, I underwent a surgery. No, it's okay, you will not allow your part to heal by reminding it, the fellow, you don't forget, huh? You were sick. It's done, it's gone. So this, but if you have to construct beautiful things. So what thoughts we want, so purification is to constantly center our thoughts around the central idea. Is this going to help me in my goal, the higher goal, for example? And then she says, set apart some time every day when one can quietly go over one's thought and put one's synthesis in order. This she describes later, that project on a cinema screen and see that you reacted in a certain way, you thought in a certain way. Is it consistent with your goal? You spoke in a certain way, in a fit of anger, driven by the ego. Maybe you thought that, oh, I'll make this fellow whatever. So who is harmed ultimately? So when you look through the day, it's a wonderful thing. Later on, when the psychic is awake, you will know it instantly, that this thought, this speech is not consistent with what I am inwardly. That's an instant process. But when one is still laboring in the mind, it's very good to look at just a mirror. That forget what the person did or didn't do. Should I have reacted this way? This thought, is it in agreement with my goal of life? This action, is it going with my goal of life? How can I reorient things? And you keep on reorienting and life moves forward. So for that, one has to set apart some time, sit quietly and go over one's thoughts. All mental vibrations can be stilled and an almost total silence secured this way. In this silence, one can gradually open to the higher regions of the mind and learn to record the inspirations that come from there. But even before reaching this point, silence in itself is supremely useful, and before one can receive the inspiration, because it gives the mind rest. And now finally she says, the fact is that like all the other parts of the human being, the mind too needs rest. The vital also needs rest. If you keep on spending energy, the nerves won't be able to take it and you'll get fatigued. So the vital needs rest, and that rest comes in quietude. The mind needs rest, that rest comes in quietude of the mind. Not through sleep, because sleep, it may continue, exhaust us. Not by simply not speaking, that's important, but then the mind may continue thinking. Not by shutting oneself in a room, because the mind may continue thinking. But to just be quiet. And if we are quiet, I have seen many confusions, many problems, they just vanish. And clarity emerges, the direction to be taken. Mind too needs rest, and it will not have the rest unless we know how to provide it. The art of resting one's mind is something to be acquired. One way, which is very common, is changing one's mental activity is certainly one way of resting. That's why people want to go through a change, you know. Let's do something else. Because most people cannot concentrate for long. They get tired, exhausted. So to engage people, so they need a little rest. To change the activity, change the subject, for example. But the greatest possible rest is silence. And as far as mental faculties are concerned, a few minutes passed in the calm of silence are a more effective rest than hours of sleep. So it doesn't require a long time. 8 hours of mental activity, come back home, take a bath, because all the formations will be washed away. Sit quietly. Do nothing. Just sit quietly. Just sit quietly. One doesn't have to necessarily concentrate, think this way, that way. Just be quiet. Just let the mind loosen up. Open up. Don't even try to think anything. Then slowly the mind will go into a state of quietude. 10 minutes is enough to come back. Bounce back. Just 10 minutes. And provide, again, mental activity can go on for much longer. It just needs a little bit. When one has learned to silence the mind at will and to concentrate it in receptive silence, then there will be no problems that cannot be solved. What a big statement. No problem. Because you'll see it very differently. 1000% you will see it very differently. Perhaps there is no problem, but we are seeing a problem. So the mind will show. And if there is a real problem, it will show us the direction we should take. Mind itself. Forget about the psychic emergence. no mental difficulties whose solution cannot be found. When it is agitated, thought becomes confused and important. In an attentive tranquility, the light can manifest itself and open up new horizons to man's capacity. So people often say, I am so agitated, I am so restless, I am trying to analyze what went wrong. I said, this is not the time to do any of this. Because you're already clouded, you will not see clearly, you will either end up blaming somebody, other person, or end up blaming yourself. Just be quiet, quiet and attentive. Then, what is paining you that this person did this to me, that to me? Probably when you wake up under the Bodhi tree, after quietude, you may say, good riddance. You may say, ah, freedom at last. Yeah, I mean, mind may say, what is the problem? You are the one who has latched on, created all the things. You think it is so important. For example, he didn't give me any money. Are you, what is it? Or gave you less money. All this mind is constructing. You think it is so important? No, that's not the important thing. Mind will suddenly show that all this money is worth nothing if you don't have peace in the heart. So you'll realize, oh my God, what a burden is taken off. Yeah. So you'll learn to be content. Whatever you have, you will learn to build in that, well, God has given me an opportunity to challenge myself. I need money, and that's the state. Now let me begin from here. Then new avenues will open, rather than lamenting, agitating, and being restless. So atha mana swadhyaya, mental education chapter from the Mother's Collected Works, Jema. I think next we'll read on psychic education.